Greetings and salutations from the Agile Revolution. Tony here.
And Craig.
And Sandy.
We're at, where are we? Yow.
We're at Yow, Brisbane. Craig doesn't know where he is because he's on the Yow tour.
Well, so is Sandy.
Yeah, and Sandy. So what city are you in today? Brisbane.
I think it's Brisbane, yeah.
Although, it thinks it's Melbourne at the moment.
Well, it's a little grey outside, isn't it? Yeah. We're just making Sandy feel at home. You know, New Zealand weather and all that kind of stuff.
Ah, there we go, yeah.
Totally works, yeah.
So for those who don't know who you are, Sandy, because we know we've followed you around for lots of years, but those who don't know who you are, give us the really quick Sandy story.
Yeah. Well, I'm an Agile coach from Auckland, New Zealand, and I've been in New Zealand for the last 10 years, and that is actually all there is to say right now. I think everything else...
Kiwi accent is actually getting pretty good.
It's like, not bad, yeah.
Yeah, you could tell that you were a foreigner from a faraway land, but from Europe. But now actually you're getting the Kiwi stuff down pretty good.
Thanks. Like, doing my best. Like, the worst would be to sound like an Austrian or German person. Working really hard.
Doing pretty well. And so you run a company out of New Zealand?
Yes, I run a company that's called Nomad 8, and we are based on Crisp in Sweden, which basically means we are a managerless organisation, and we work together in almost a collective way where we all pay into a pot of money, and for that we run the company. Hmm. And we focus on Agile coaching, training, and consulting.
Yeah, very successfully too. I know you're being modest, but so I guess I came across you a number of years ago in what we call the Lost Podcast, which we won't speak of.
We've had a number of them over the years.
It was amazing, that podcast.
It was, but I came across you, I guess, in the whole idea of personal Kanban, or what you were calling Kanban for one. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that, because. I mean, your Kanban for one board is still something I use on a regular basis. I probably travel a little too much to use it as much as I would like to, but whenever I'm working out at home. But just tell us a little bit about how that all came about.
Yeah, well, it started with working at Snapper and having a team of people who...
Snapper is a
transport ticketing provider in Wellington. And we had a group of people, and they were really happy running Scrum and Kanban for some teams. And at some point, we realized there were people who are across teams, and they would actually like to work in the same way. So they just took the big board from the team, scaled it down into a small one-person board. And because at some point it got too complicated to manually make those boards, those personal Kanban boards, we started going to a printer and making this on a larger scale. Mm-hmm. And it has helped many of us, including me, to be more focused and not stress too much about all the things that I have to do. So it has helped my personal productivity.
And they're beautiful boards. Like, they, they're I guess made of that sort of, really thick cardboard type, type material. But what I really like is how you've done the whip limits on there, that you just can't quite fit that third post-it note in the doing column.
That's exactly right.
And you feel guilty of running it across the line.
You do, yes.
And I have an ownership on that one is that I work with a surf club, Surf Lifesaving Club. So I was the chairperson for quite some time. Had a lot of things to do other than my normal life, and that's what I used it for. So it was very successful for me because I had a lot of things that I had to do after hours and to make the thing happen. And every beginning of every season, I'd have my list and my whip and you felt guilty about running it across the line.
And I still wonder why that is, because I've got it too, and I think people are a bit like cats. We like boxes and we don't cross the lines.
Yeah, don't cross the streams. Ghostbusters. Yeah.
Yes.
I think it's just that visual thing. It's like, I shouldn't go past there.
Exactly. It almost hurts.
And one thing I remember you saying to me, and it could have been on that Lost Podcast, but I'm never going to let that down.
He's never going to let it down now.
And I can say I never said this.
It'll surface. But you were kind of almost blissfully unaware of Jim Benson and his work there initially, right?
Yes.
So, I guess, were you kind of on the same wavelength? Was there any sort of differences that you found when you finally discovered that there was actually this whole personal Kanban thing in a completely other direction?
I think it's very, very similar. And one of the differences is that Jim's idea is a system, whereas ours is coming with a tool. Mm. So it's a particular board and it's a particular workflow, whereas Jim's personal Kanban can be any workflow. It's just that I found that whenever it's personal and you're a knowledge worker, it's probably really to do needs doing done and not that many variations.
So. People love tools, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you still buy the boards? Are they still
Where can we get online those? At nomad8.com. Mm-hmm. There is a little shop, and we have actually new designs, and we have like beautiful thick cardboard boards that stand up on your desk, but we also, because some of us travel around like me, have thinner fold-up boards that fit into A3.
Ah, Craig, there we go.
Excuse me, I have to go over the store and buy one.
Before we talk about Nomads,
yes,
Craig would be one.
Well, I'll bring you some tomorrow. I brought some here.
I'll have, we'll have to check that out. So they're called Kanban for One store, right?
Yes, yeah. And that URL still works too, kanbanforone.com. Yes.
So I guess since I spoke to you, awesome book you released a few years ago with David Mole. But the name escaped me. Well, it's got puppies on the front of it.
Yes.
So the name of the book is, it's about self-selection of teams.
Yep.
The name of the book is Creating Great Teams?
Creating Great Teams, How Self-Selection Lets People Excel.
Yeah, I knew it was something. Great book. It's one of those little, if people haven't seen, it's one of those little books that you can kind of read on a plane flight, in a couple of hours. I guess that's. I talk to people. I don't know if you've had experience with this, Tony. Mm. When people hear this idea of selecting teams who haven't been down that road before, it's a very foreign idea. So, just tell us a little bit about how you got into that. Because what I really like about your story is, whilst lots of people have talked about this, you've shared the journey. Firstly, you shared it in papers and talks, and now the book really shares that. Whereas a lot of people come with these things and they don't share that stuff. So, how did it all come about?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you like that we share the journey, because I agree very often that this is how you do something, and we didn't just come up with the perfect solution. We had a problem ourselves that we needed to solve. And what happened to us was that we were introducing Agile at a major New Zealand company called Trade Me. It's an e-commerce company. And we had started with four teams, and they were all very happy doing Agile, and then everyone else started to be really envious. And they were not working in fixed teams. They were working in project teams and being pulled off and on. And we thought, right, we need to get them into teams really, really quickly. And then we started doing management selection, trying to put people into teams. And we realized it's really hard. People are never happy. Everyone whinges about being put in the team they're being put in. So how about we just assume...
So did you actually have a failed implementation of it initially? Did that actually happen? Or were you already aware, because we all know that fails, was that something that you were able to explain to management?
Yeah. It hadn't failed yet, but it was just really, really hard. And
so you're sitting in the meeting room trying to put people in the buckets.
Yeah. And deciding George should go into this team because we want to do right by George, and then find out someone talks to George and says, oh, actually, he doesn't want to work in that team and wants to do something different. And
or even worse, wow. Who's George?
Yeah.
Or George doesn't like Bob, and Bob doesn't like George.
Exactly, yeah. And then we had a ship it day, and it was really beautiful. It was my first one like years ago. And I watched people sign up to projects and small projects for 24 hours and getting together into teams. And everyone found a team. No one put themselves on two teams. No one was concerned with utilization. People were cross-skilled, and they could really sort it for a ship it day or a hackathon. And I thought, well, if they can do it there, I wonder if that will work in real life. And my very first thought was, oh, it's a shame it would never work. And then I realized, wow, I'm kind of institutionalized. This is horrible. So why shouldn't I? So I raced up to David and said, hey, this is what we need to do. And he said, sure. And what I found out later, what he told me later, was he was really thinking, this is never going to work. So what's next? And what I heard was, oh, he likes it. So this is clearly a good idea. And so we started to work together on how to make something like this happen. And,
so did David have authority in that company to do that?
Yep. Mm.
So that had to be a key that someone who had some skin in the game.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he did. He was kind of the head of the PMO. Mm-hmm. He was the only member of the PMO. But he had some power, he had some authority.
He's the head of the PMO when you're the only PMO.
Well, that's it.
Yes.
Is that a personal management? No, anyway.
Yeah. I think he was supposed to start a PMO, but actually then ended up introducing Agile with me. And so he had some authority, but not the type of authority where he could just decide this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
We had to talk to a lot of people, to both management, but also the people who got the chance to self-select.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it was actually equally much work to convince both of them.
Mm-hmm.
So my question there, when you talk about it, because I've seen this attempted a couple of times
yep.
recently, it's the old HR question. How did they take it? Were they a blocker, or how did you get them on side? Because obviously it changes the structures of how people go, and usually restructures are the
yep.
domain of the HR people, right? So you're starting
True.
To step on,
yes.
on their toes.
Yep. I have done many self-selections now, and in none of those have we changed reporting structures in any way. This is the daily work where you are on a team, but you're still reporting to the same person outside. It has nothing to do with that. So I think changing...
Do you think Spotify has helped that a little bit? Like, I know we, yep. don't, I know we don't call it a model or any of those kind of
yep.
things, right? But because people are okay with this tribes and squads type
yes.
idea?
Oh, totally. That was, we had read that paper and said, ooh, this sounds amazing. We want that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just said, how do we actually do that? Because Spotify, they kind of start in teams. They're born agile.
Mm.
And we just had a pile of people we needed to get into teams.
Yeah. Mm.
And we were kind of failing at management selection. It wasn't that great. And I was like, right, let's just ask people to do it and see if they can help us figure it out or just figure it out for themselves.
Because I do remember reading the paper I can't remember what the first thing was, paper you put out, I think, originally on this. And I remember, oh, yeah, it's trading. They're a 200-person company
yeah.
or something like in New Zealand. So, you know, why that
yeah,
work.
Yeah.
But as you mentioned now, you've had success at doing this at all
yeah.
sorts of companies
yep.
in all sorts of shapes and sizes, from
yes.
a 20-person company to, I assume,
yep.
Many, many thousand-person
yes.
companies like big banks and
yeah.
the stuff. Do you find the size of the company has any bearing on it, or actually are you finding that people are kind of open to this?
Yeah, not really. I've seen banks and it worked really well, and it depends on how many people you have simultaneously in a room. We've done it with up to 200 people, and that worked really well. And if I had a 5,000 people company, I would split it up into tribes first of 150 to 200 people, and then do a self-selection. But I had the same thoughts, like, yeah, okay, we've done this at a tech company, young people, they're relatively open. And then the next thing that happened was we went out with a paper, and I was hoping people would take it and run with it. And they did. And two things happened. One is people started feeding back to me, and they still do the self-selections they do all across the world. And the other thing that happened was that a bank, the ASB, approached me and asked me if we wanted to do a self-selection there. And that was really interesting, and it worked. And to be honest, I didn't know at the time whether it would work or not, if it's just a small tech company or a big bank too. And I was positively surprised that it did work.
Is the secret then, when you're in a large organisation, that that tribe structure, I guess, is the self-select? Because I can imagine
yeah.
that, you know, if you try to take a large bank in Australia, for example, where there are tens of thousands of employees, sometimes even the IT department,
yes.
There's a scale that this starts.
Yep.
You talk about a couple of hundred type
yep.
thing. So there still is a trick to getting people in the right tribe, I guess.
Yes.
Or would you
yep.
help people self-select into tribes as
yeah.
well? Because what if I'm on the outside, right? What
yeah.
if there's 500 people, even 200 people That's meeting over here in the gym,
yes.
self-selecting
yeah.
up to their
yeah,
teams,
yeah.
and I'm the 201st person who's kind of annoyed that I haven't been involved in the... I can
yes.
imagine there could be issues
yeah.
there.
Yeah, I think so too, but you usually want to find there are departments already, and like in a bank, there's a department, and usually they're not too big, and it is doable.
Hmm. So it's a secret then to put something else around the outside of that, like... like Heidi here at this Health and Stalking,
yep.
She's got a dynamic reteaming book out
yes.
there, where she talks about the fact that it's okay to change teams, and
yes.
it's okay to say that I want a job swap or
yes.
move here. Does that work very much hand in hand with this?
Yeah, totally. Like, I think what I've seen, like, self-selection is really hard if people believe they're signing away their lives. Because... I would struggle with it. It's like, whoa, what if I choose the wrong team and I'm stuck here and actually don't like the people, so my risk will be low. I will also not compromise on behalf of my company. But I usually do sales selections again every 6 to 9 months in a company. So even if you end up in a job or in a team you don't really want to, you know you get the chance to change next time. And you know you can take one for the team. And even if you get it wrong, so we had an agreement that if people got it wrong, we would ask them not to switch within the first couple of weeks, but to actually work through it. But hated it, then sure, you can swap.
Yeah, that's great, because the one I saw fail, they didn't do that.
Right.
And that just, people got into teams and then realised and went, I don't want to be here, and it turned into a rather large turmoil.
Yep.
So, yeah,
that's huge pressure.
Yeah, I think that's a massive key on that. The other thing I just experienced recently, and I was lucky to be part of the team, so it's self-selection in the reverse, I guess, is that as a team, we were able to self-select our own leader.
Mm-hmm.
So we interviewed our own leader.
Nice.
So we, as a team, went through multiple interviews of leaders, asking them why we should let them lead us.
Very cool. How did that go?
It was a very interesting experience, but it was a very positive experience because the leader we ended up with was really, really good. As she's listening, I'm talking about you.
How's that team doing now, Tony?
Let's not go there. But it was a very interesting experience, and at the time I went, it's self-selection in reverse, sort of.
Yes.
And so that's something that I think I would really encourage people to try or enable. So we were lucky that we had a leader above that that enabled it.
Yes.
Because their thought pattern was, if I'm going to have someone lead this high-performing team, then the team's got to be happy with that person instead of just foisting someone on them.
Yes.
So it was a very interesting experience.
Yeah. I think like my ultimate dream would be to combine it, like to I haven't worked out in the process, but both that self-selected team who selects a leader and even the team structure is designed by the people, like instead of, because I've always done like, what teams do we need? That's management designed. And then people select which team they want to be in. But instead going, hey, what teams do you think we need?
Yeah, I think that's
just
great.
Just chuck them a strategy.
Because ultimately, if you listen, it's the old thing that I always go back to in terms of agility, right? Listen to your people. They actually know what's going on. They're the guys who've got to deal with it on the ground. Yes. And 9 times out of 10, they know what they need to get there. We just need to enable them instead of giving them these half-assed broken solutions that some management guy thought was... works.
Yep. And as leaders and managers, I think we are still really helpful in terms of like facilitating that outcome, asking the right questions when people have blind spots when they self-select or when they choose a leader.
Hmm. It was interesting you said about the sign-up, because that was actually the question I was going to ask. My understanding is that, at least from the paper, I'm pretty sure the book as well, you actually have the team structures set up. Do you? I guess two parts to that. One is, you kind of answered that before. Do you see a place where that may evolve? But secondly, do you find even when you do it now that when people get in and they see that structure and people are torn that actually I need to be in this team and this team, that they actually do end up changing the team structures around, or are you fairly rigid on the team staying the same?
I have seen it a couple of times that we have realised there are. Realised it wasn't the right teams.
And, so through the two-way glass and seeing what they're...
Yes, And I know that M. Campbell Pretty told me about a situation where they had a team and nobody signed up for that team. So they realised this team shouldn't exist. And management took that to heart and decided not to have that team.
Wow.
We have also, at the ASB, we had one team and they just couldn't figure out who should be in that team, and it grew and it didn't make sense. They just couldn't sort it until someone decided, had the idea, why don't we just make two teams out of this with those particular purposes? And everyone, oh yeah, and that worked. So it's not like everything totally changes, but there are changes during a self-selection sometimes to team structure.
Hmm. Well, and when you have that sort of realisation, is that something where you come back and have another go at it? Or, because I mean, were there people hanging over on the side that didn't have anywhere to go? Or, you know, like, does it take multiple iterations sometimes to get through it?
For a self-selection?
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
I've never seen it done in the first round. So now I think it's impossible. And what's interesting is there seems to be a pattern. Like, the first one... completely off. I've seen teams with 7 developers or just 6 testers, and no, you can't deliver anything. And people are still shy putting themselves into the teams. And then round 2 is kind of a little bit better, and I find usually in round 3 people start having conversations, seeing the bigger picture, seeing, hey, what if you and I swap, would that work? And there seems to be some kind of breakthrough around 3 weeks.
Do you do them typically in the same day?
Those are 10-minute rounds.
That's short.
Really, yep. 10-minute rounds, then 5 minutes of feeding back to the room to get information who is missing what, and then another 10-minute round.
Okay, maybe I'm doing it wrong. Maybe I'm going to take on too long. There you go. learn from the master. So here you're here at Yao. You're talking about, people haven't read your bio before, you're a former Olympian in the sport of handball, and you're reflecting on, I guess, the experiences of being a technology person or an agilist, to your experiences being Olympian. Awesome talk. Between all 3 conferences, I'll actually get to see all three thirds of it, but you always seem to get called out of your talks for some reason. But tell us a little bit about that.
Basically, I went to the 1992 Olympic Games, and at some point, like 25 years later, I realised that has actually had quite an impact on me, and mostly...
And I guess I've known you for a while. I remember when I first met you, that was never in your bio, really. I mean, you weren't hiding it, but it was something I remember was more of something you had to dig for to find, and now it's something you seem to almost matured and found.
I was kind of hiding it, because in professional sports there's so many people who it's their lives, then they stop, and then they keep hanging on somehow and can't let go. And I didn't want to do that, so I completely stopped, changed actually identity. It's like, right, I just focus on something else. And
so that's where you end up, New Zealand, right? There we
are. Yes, right away. And then, at some point I say, oh, actually, there are too many times when I talk about I do this, I do that, and I realise this comes from having been a professional athlete. And also realised there were many things that I kind of had problems with, I had a different approach to than other people in software development or agile.
It's interesting. It's something that I can align myself with, because as Craig and others know, I had a career long before this in the music and the radio industry, and I walked away from it.
Yep.
And that didn't appear anywhere to do with me for a very long time, because I thought that was something that didn't fit what I was doing.
Yes.
Now, doing podcasts, doing the agile thing, talking to people, I realised it is what I am.
Yes.
And all those experiences that you packed into that affect what you do on a daily basis.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny how long it takes before you actually realise and come back to that, and it's okay to talk about it.
Yeah.
How many years did it take you?
Oh, 10 at least, I would have.
Keep going.
Yeah, maybe. There you go.
Right.
Well, when did we start doing the podcast? Because I really hadn't done anything to do with... Yeah. That type of thing again. So what 2011?
Yeah.
Right, and I walked away in 93.
Oh wow. Yep.
So
interesting.
Yeah. And the day I walked away was the day I walked away.
Yep.
So much like yourself. Same. And I think it's that compartmentalization of it that you do just put it aside and you don't want to think about it.
Yep. So. Yep. Very much. And then it comes back.
Yeah.
So I see a lot of people have walked out of your, you gave the talk at Ads Australia, was it?
Well, they all walked out. That's no good.
No.
What? Craig, come on.
At the end.
Okay.
At the end. But people walk out inspired. Well, let me spit it out. what is it about the story, do you think, that's really resonating with people? I mean, there are lots of messages in there. Is there anything particularly that you think that...
I think the one that seems to resonate most is how to select your team or your company or the people you work with. And my number one guiding principle is to be the worst player on the best team that will take you. And that's when I find many people realise that actually that's not what's happening to them. And I talk about that this is an area of learning, and it amplifies learning. but also that it's a horrible place to be in because it's really, really hard to be the worst person because you feel really inadequate because you are. And so I think it's that, including the that it's okay to leave a team. Like, don't be a dick about it and go see ya. But the transfer windows in professional sports, and I think as long as we in our software development teams have a succession plan and don't just leave from one day to the other, then it's okay to leave and find a better team. And we worry about it all the time and what will people think. No professional athlete would think about that twice.
And it's okay to learn, I guess, is the other part of that.
I love the way that you still build in the basic agile principles of, you know, you test and learn, right? Yes. And retrospective.
Yep.
You know, you Kaizen, right? Make things better.
Yep.
And I think that's a brilliant piece to what you're doing. Do you think that's what resonates with them as well? It resonated with me.
Yeah. I think so. I hope so. I find different people always pick different pieces, and I think that seems to be a big one too. The failing and managing the risk. The you don't want to fail during the Olympics, so you fail before when it's not that important.
Yeah, because I think that's one of the biggest misnomers in agile today. Mm-hmm. I talked about this myself a while ago. Is the word fail and safe to fail? And everybody sees that as, well, we can do whatever we want and fail. But you've got to have a plan, Stan. You've got to be able to mitigate the fail and operate in a sense where it's okay to fail and not take your company down or take your team down, right?
It's okay to learn.
That's what we're trying to say, right? So I think it's one of that fail thing can be a really dangerous double-edged sword.
Yes.
Don't use four-letter F words as we're using my writing principle.
Nice one.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
So
I agree.
So you're from the little country of New Zealand, over just over a couple of hours flight away from us. It's a country that, you've been the guy, you were in Wellington for a lot of years, and we've spoken before about Agile Welly, which you ran for many years, was, I think, one of the largest Agile groups, certainly larger than the Australian ones at one point. So it's a country that's been on the forefront of Agile for a while, but what is the state of play of Agile in New Zealand? What are you seeing, and comparing it to a country like Australia, or even, you go to the US and things as well, how do you feel it's stacking up?
Personally, I think that Australia and New Zealand are pretty close. You get amazing companies and you get companies that are not doing so great. But overall, both here and in New Zealand, I see really good things. And I think, and I hope no one from the US hears me, actually I stand by it, I think both countries... I can just say that. I really believe that we are ahead. I think both Australia and New Zealand are ahead of the US.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
I think we have smaller companies, and I think being 10,000 people is not helpful, and we are also less rigid, and there's not as much fear. Like, we all have health insurance. We all go to work because we enjoy it and want to have some job satisfaction out of this. There's a lot more fear in the US, and I think fear definitely inhibits learning, which is why I think
That's interesting. I was wondering whether you would even say that compared New Zealand to Australia, because the size of large companies, no disrespect New Zealand, you're a small company, which means that the size of the companies, just by definition, if they're not owned by an Australian, I guess, but size by definition is that they're smaller. In fact, even when you think about the banks, whilst a lot of the banks there, rightly or wrongly, are owned by by bigger banks, they are very much autonomous. Some really good things come out of New Zealand banking sector, for example, even though they're owned by big Aussie banks, they're far more in advance of a lot of the Australian counterparts. Yeah. And I'm just wondering, do you think the size...
I think size... Size does matter. In this case, the smaller the better. guys, the smaller the better.
It's colour red, Tony.
That's the end of the podcast. No. I think that's a very Kiwi answer, by the way. So Kiwis are better than the Australians, but then when it's the rest of the world, the Kiwis and the Australians are better than the rest of the world, right? We always band together, right?
Exactly.
That's how it works. It's Anzac, right?
Yeah.
But I also think, interestingly enough, I also think it's about the age of our companies. So I can't remember who this was I was reading, but they postulated that our companies are nowhere near as old in the tooth as many of the American companies.
Yeah.
And because of the age of the American companies, such as their institutional memory,
mm-hmm.
that it builds that fear and that loathing and that they do not want to change. And even when they do take the agile journey, it takes longer to actually turn the coin than it does for our smaller companies.
Yeah, that's probably true. And when I go to conferences, when I go to either Agile Australia or LAST or YAL, there's a lot more new stuff, a lot more innovation than I have seen during a number of years in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really like it.
Yeah, interesting. So we've mentioned Nomad 8, I guess just to wrap up, I want to come back to that. You guys are always doing interesting stuff. One of the things that you guys released, I guess not so recently, were just these little cards for, I think you got them for the Manifesto and you got them for Modern Agile. Tell us a little bit about those, because they're a good resource for some of our listeners.
Yeah. So we, at some point I found out people really respond well when we give them physical cards and they discuss things. So we have cards around Modern Agile, and we have changed some of the Agile principles to resonate also with people who don't necessarily develop software. And so I think they fit quite well together, and we use them when we teach Agile to have people discuss how they do. And the other set of cards that we have are lift-off cards, because very often I lift off or kick off teams, and I want to leave it up to them what it is they want to do. So I give them a set of cards, they get a day or half a day with me, and choose the activity and build the plan.
Build your own agenda.
Yeah. Mm. And most of the things I have done before and know how to do, but I've chucked in a couple of MVPs, so if anyone chooses it, I will figure out how to do it. And that's how I learned how to do, but have tried mock programming, for example, because someone chose that. Mm. And all those cards are available for free somewhere on our blog, nomad8.com, and search.
Awesome.
And you can print them yourselves.
Excellent. That's fantastic. What brought that about?
I think the lift-off cards, because I was working at TradeMe and I was kicking off teams all the time, and then we have self-selections and people move around. And I don't remember who has done what and what I should do with whom, because now it's a new team with new people and that person has done this and this other person hasn't. I thought, actually, I'm going to make this your problem. It's like, what would you like to do as a team? And there were some surprises in there, like I thought people wouldn't want to repeat stuff, but then lots of people were going, ooh, I've done this and the other kickoff with my old squad, and I think we should totally do this again now. And it worked really well.
Brilliant.
Awesome. Yeah, very, very coaching approach to it. Give them the problem and let them find their own way.
That's what I call lazy facilitator normally. I tell them straight up, I'm a lazy facilitator.
Yep.
You're going to do the work. I'm just here to help make you happen.
I take no responsibility if you don't like it.
So you've always been someone on the cutting edge. So I guess the question I ask is you're someone I always look up to. You're always, you're a step ahead of other people that I follow, I guess. So is there anything, that's next coming for you, things that you're just looking at right now that might be coming down the line or just piqued your interest?
Yeah. During the past year, I have had the chance to try out Holacracy with a Snapper transport ticketing provider, and that was a really interesting experience.
Mm-hmm.
And both learned a lot and are still running Holacracy, but I think it would be a Holacracy butt, so probably not allowed to call it Holacracy. And it was exciting because we went through something like very much in the olden days, Scrum 1.0, where everyone just followed all the rules to the letter. And then we found out actually there are principles, so some of those don't really work for us, so let's just remember the principle and see which parts we take.
Mm.
And we went through that with Holacracy, so there's some parts that work really well for us, and let's remember the principles. And what that is, what has been doing for me is the bigger thought around this is we have all those IT teams and we give them autonomy, but then there are interfaces with marketing and finance and legal. So how about we actually make bigger circles and have a finance role on a team? That's what Snapper do now. There's a finance role on each team, there's a marketing role on each team, and pushing that decision making into a circle has speeded up tremendously. And has also made sure that we make better decisions. So I love experimenting with that, and I see it as an extension of self-selection of autonomous teams, and not just have autonomous IT teams, but autonomous bigger teams, and how do you actually structure an organization to make fast and good decisions.
Locracy is one of those things that you can go and do a certified course for. Is that something you had gone and done, or have you just basically read through the books and gone from there?
Funny thing is that I had read a quarter of the book when Snapper asked me if I wanted to help them, and I told them, guys, I'm completely unqualified. And they said, great, at least you won't be biased. Let's figure it out together.
So that's great.
We all read the book together. We read all the material we could find and learned it that way and experimented.
Yeah, because I've heard people do. I've heard people, well, Renee on our podcast.
Yeah, that's right.
Has done the course. And even she's kind of struggling. And I didn't think you had. I didn't think I'd seen that you'd done that. Mm. But yeah, having read the book myself, it's. I just haven't had, I guess, the opportunity to try it anyway. So
yeah, I'm the same.
Yeah,
but it's interesting that it's like the golden age, like you're saying, the golden age of Scrum, where it was just. There's a book out there, and let's just try it and see what happens.
Yeah, and it feels like Scrum 1.0, and I think it's going to evolve. It's going to evolve in something into something good. Mm. Whether it will be called Holacracy or something else, doesn't really matter, but there's something there with Holacracy and Sociocracy and learning organisations, development. What are developmental organisations? What
it's
are they called?
Developracy, there you go.
Yeah, we're just getting a Holacracy.
Yep. So, I think there's something interesting there, and I don't know exactly what it's going to be, but that's kind of where I'm moving.
So I guess the question is, you said it was a Holacracy, but in that particular organisation, would you say that they're the better for having gone through this?
Yes.
Even if they're not quite at some... Nirvana, whatever that might be.
Yeah, I think it was better for us because we knew what we had made a conscious decision. We're not going to follow this rigid meeting structure because it stops us from collaborating, and we can achieve the goal in a much better way. So it has helped, but we went through it and we could decide this is what it will feel like. This is why we are not doing it, and what is it we need to make sure we don't lose. So it made for a better and more well-informed decision.
That's fantastic. So the butt piece, right? So you obviously learnt the lessons about what would work.
Yep.
So that's good. And when you go to the next organisation and try this, but what I would take from what you're saying is the butts might be different for that organisation as opposed to those ones. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. So it's still go through something as close as possible and then decide use this, don't use this.
Right. Yeah. Because I wanted to position that because I know. Whoever does listen to this, but if somebody's listening to it, they'll go, oh, well, they did it that way. We better remove the butts and just do it, because that's what they do, right? I had the same thing with scaling agile, right? You can't.
Well, it feels to me like a much more, I hate to say this word, much more agile way of scaling. It's not a pure scaling method, but to me, it feels like a much better thing than just trying to make things bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we could speak for another 3 hours, but we're nowhere to get through to another session. So thanks for taking time to talk to us, Sandy. If people want to find out more about you and what you're up to, where do they find out more?
Yeah. That would be on nomad8.com. That's awesome. Where there's everything about self-selection and everything I do in our blog.
Yeah, and lots of other really good people at Nomad 8. I'll give you guys a shout out. And I haven't sat in any of your courses, but I hear great things. So, and you also run a conference too, right?
Yes, I run a conference called JAFAC, which is just another Agile conference.
There's a bleep. I just had to get the bleep.
And it's a very small conference. It's day one is presentations, day two is an unconference or is open space.
Excellent.
And we are creating the conference that we want to be at. And then we invite other people.
Awesome. Well, I guess that's all we have to say. If people want to know more, Tony, where they find out more?
They can find out from Tony at The Agile Revolution.
Yeah, and I'm Craig, TheAgileRevolution.com. So only one last thing to do?
I think there's only one last thing to do, and we're going to get Sandy to do it with us.
Yeah, so one, two, three.
Viva la revolution!
Thanks, Sandy.
Thank you.